Well, we're glad you guys decided to spend a little time with us. Sorry it's so warm, but it's actually cooling off. You feel it? And by the way, these like front pews are actually the coolest pews in the whole place because of these windows right here, so you may want to kind of wander in a little further next time. Every once in a while, the media brings us a story that seems to capture our attention, and I'll reveal a little bit of kind of my nerdiness. How many of you know that today ended one of the world's greatest sporting events of all time? Does anybody even know that? Two, maybe three people? The Tour de France ended today, and Cadel Evans rolled down the Champs-Élysées into Paris, France, to win a over 2,000-mile, 84-hour bicycle race that took about 3.5 weeks. Absolutely astounding. Now, again, I'm the only nerd probably that watched just about every day that I could in there. But there are other news stories that grab our attentions, maybe even more. In fact, we may date ourselves here. I got a picture. Take a look at this picture. How many people know what this is a picture of? Anybody? Only those that are probably 30 or 35 and older. Shout it out. Who is that? Baby Jessica, some 20, maybe 25 years ago, a young woman, a young baby, just a few months old, fell down a well and was pinned a few hundred feet down in a water well. She had crawled away from her mom. Her mom went to grab a phone or something like that. She fell down a well, and it captured the imagination. It captured the attention of everybody, at least in the United States and maybe even the entire world. And this is a picture after about a 2.5-day rescue operation of the miner who drilled down and kind of somehow got in there and slathered her up with Vaseline and then somehow got her up above the ground. This actually won a Pulitzer Prize, this picture, an absolutely incredible photo. This is a little more recent, the next one. Check this out. Anybody know this? Where's that? In Chile, this year, maybe just at the end of last year, the miners in Chile who spent over a week, I think almost 2 weeks, down in a mine shaft, and one of the most extensive operations, rescue operations ever endeavored, saved every single person. Again, captured the world's imagination. It was absolutely incredible. And sometimes that happens, where we get to celebrate, we get to admire, we get to love what we see in the news, but oftentimes we see or we hear the opposite. In fact, yesterday, some of you probably know, Amy Winehouse died in her London apartment. We don't know the details of it, but it's an incredibly tragic situation. And my guess is over the next couple of weeks, we'll continue to hear, as the news unfolds, the life of Amy Winehouse and the tragedy of her early death at 27 years old. In fact, there's a couple of other pictures that I'm going to show you up here of stories of CEOs, of pastors, of athletes, of politicians, of people who have done incredibly unwise things. At the pinnacle, it seems, of their career, they have gone and taken all of this incredible opportunity that's been given to them, and for lots of various reasons, they've thrown them away, haven't they? Remember MC Hammer? A little Hammer Time, a little Michael Vick. Michael's trying to revive his career. Paris Hilton. And of course, you can't go without Iron Mike Tyson. See, these people had opportunity. Many or most of them had wealth. They had privilege. They had power. They had opportunity that most of us in this room probably can't even fathom or imagine. And yet somehow, somewhere, for some reason, something went wrong. And now we look at them and their stories aren't about their power or their fame. Their stories are about tragedy. But their stories are about how they ended. In many ways, I think we have a story to tell as well. And God is in the process of telling your story and mine. And while I doubt anyone has captured the world's attention the way that maybe some of these people, either on the good side or the bad side, have, each of us has a story that's currently being written. And in many ways, even though we may not get to the depths of how some of these people have gotten, we've all been at points in our lives where we wonder, how did I get here? I mean, what was I thinking? How could I have been so, and you can fill in the blank, how could I have been so stupid, so insensitive, so greedy? How could I have been so thoughtless? What was I thinking? And the question always leads to a bigger question, and that is, what went wrong? I mean, with so much opportunity, what went wrong? Even in our lives. Well, this question is going to be posed to us over the next couple of weeks as we examine one of maybe the most famous characters in the Scriptures. His name is Solomon. He was a king in the nation of Israel. And the Bible tells us that Solomon was the wisest, the wealthiest, maybe the most privileged man of all times. And yet, as we see Solomon's story unfold, it resembles some of the images that we just looked at. Solomon's life with incredible power, incredible privilege, incredible opportunity, wealth beyond our imagination, ended with a man who wrote in the Scriptures that all life seems meaningless. Nothing but a chasing after the wind. And so we're left wondering, what in the world went wrong with this guy Solomon? Now let me give you a little detail, a little background as to who Solomon is. Solomon was the son of David. Now, if you know anything about the Scriptures, you've probably heard the name David. This is David of David and Goliath, right? He's a big dog. This is the guy who every Jew would say is the greatest king to ever live. Solomon was the son of the king. So you can imagine that comes with tremendous privilege. Solomon came to power because God told King David that even though he's not the firstborn, Solomon is to be the next king. So again, he usurped or essentially jumped over some of his older brothers to take over the kingship. He did so in his mid-20s. Again, tremendous privilege, tremendous opportunity. And when he did so, he and his father, David, ruled side by side for a time, for a season. Solomon saw amazing prosperity in his kingdom for the early part of his kingdom. And yet in the latter part of his kingdom, we see a decline maybe unmatched ever in the entire Scriptures. And so we're asked, what went wrong? I mean, Solomon, with all of the things you had going for you, what in the world went wrong? And he ends up in a lonely, bitter, agonizing place where in the end he questions everything, maybe even God, and wonders whether life is meaningless. Before we dive into the story, I want to tell you why, at least I think, this story has been included in the Bible. You see, this is a little bit history, but I think it's even bigger than history, because just studying history maybe fills our minds with information about Solomon, king, and the kingdoms of Israel, and that's helpful. But I think it's far more important than that, because, see, while we can't change Solomon's story, that's history, right? That's written. We can change our story. See, even as we think and talk and read about the events and the decisions in Solomon's life that led to his downfall, we can't change that. And yet as we think, as we talk about his story, hopefully we can change a little bit of our story. And my prayer for us, for me, and for you, has been that each of us would discover or rediscover perhaps how God's love, how God's protection, how God's plan for us is to prosper us, not to harm us. And hopefully Solomon can teach us a little bit about that. So let's dive in. If you have a Bible, we're going to be taking a look at the book of 1 Kings. And in your pew Bibles, this is found on page 229, 1 Kings 229. We're going to take a look at three different chapters of it in just little excerpts. We'll also put these up on the screen in just a minute. So a little bit of background before we dive into this. Again, Solomon, son of King David, one of the greatest, maybe the greatest king of all times. In fact, the Scriptures say David was a man after God's own heart. God tells David that Solomon, his son, not his firstborn son, but a maybe fourthborn son, is to be the next king, which kind of frustrates everybody in the kingdom. Now, David is getting old in age when we start this story. He's getting up there, and any time a king is ending the end of his reign or his throne, everybody gets a little nervous, because that's when coups happen, that's when other revolts can come in and take over the kingdom. And so everybody's starting to get a little nervous and wonder, how is David going to handle this? What is the transition to the next king going to look like? Word starts to get out that Solomon has been tapped as king. And there's actually another brother who tries to usurp his authority. We see in the very beginning of this chapter, there's another brother who tries to take the kingship right out from under him. And immediately David squashes that and says Solomon is going to be king. Now early on in Solomon's reign, we actually see one of the most amazing stories, because Solomon, in a dream, shortly after God has told his father David that he's going to be king, Solomon in a dream is told by God that he can have anything that he wants. Anything. Isn't that a great question from God? You can have anything you want. What would you choose? Well, Solomon, as a 25-year-old would-be king of maybe one of the greatest kingdoms in the entire Eastern or ancient Near East, asks for wisdom. He could have asked for wealth. He could have asked for power. He could have asked for a unified kingdom that lasts forever and ever. And instead, Solomon asks for wisdom. And God was exceedingly joyful about that. And not only did God give Solomon wisdom, he said in this dream, but he would give him wealth and power beyond anything the world had ever seen. And then Solomon wakes up. And he looks around and wonders, what was that all about? And a little bit later in his kingship, if you know anything about how kings ruled, generally there were lower courts. And anything that couldn't be settled in lower courts was eventually brought to the king. He was quite literally the supreme council. And so one dispute came before Solomon. You may have heard this story before. Two women claiming to have ownership of the same baby brought the baby before Solomon. And both of them are hysterical. You can imagine, right? Both of them put the baby forward and say, it's mine. And they're, you know, probably disputing. No, it's mine. No, it's mine. Solomon says, silence. And he asks for a sword from his court attendant. And you can hear kind of the air being sucked out of the room. The attendant says, a sword? What do you? Okay, we'll get you a sword. And as Solomon lifts the sword right before the baby, he explains, I'm going to cut the baby in half and give a half to each of you. And that way you can be satisfied. One woman kind of snickers with joy, and the other sobs and says, no, please don't kill the baby. Give it to that woman. I'm okay without it. And immediately everybody in the room says, whoa, dude, that was awesome. And it may have been the very first, that's a rough translation of the Hebrew. It wasn't exactly how it was stated. But everybody in the room at that moment said, this guy has got what it takes. And suddenly this young 25, 26-year-old guy captured the imagination of the entire nation of Israel. And at that point, Solomon probably realized, you know what, that dream, it may have come true. That's incredible. What God said, wisdom and maybe even power, wealth, beyond my imagination, maybe God meant that. And so let's take a few steps back and see if we can revisit this. We're going to take a look at 1 Kings. We're in chapter 1, verse 32. 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 32. And this is again in your pew Bibles on page 229. 1 Kings 1, chapter 32. King David said, call in Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah son of Jehoiada. When they came before the king, he said to them, take your Lord's servants with you and have Solomon my son mount my own mule, and take him down to Gihon. There have Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him king over Israel. Blow the trumpet and shout, long live King Solomon. Then you are to go up with him, and he's to come and sit on my throne and reign in my place. I have appointed him ruler over Israel and Judah. Benaiah, by the way, who was the warrior. Anytime a king had his court in front of him, he had the priest, the prophet, and the warrior. So Benaiah, the warrior, son of Jehoiada, answered the king, amen. May the Lord, the God of my Lord, the king, so declare it. In other words, I will protect you with my life. All of my men will fight for you. As the Lord was with my Lord, the king, so may he be with Solomon to make his throne even greater than the throne of my Lord, King David. And so David essentially squashes this maybe a little bit of an uprising by one of Solomon's brothers and anoints Solomon king of Israel. Now, David and Solomon reigned for a little bit of time, probably a few years, before David finally grew sick enough to where he had to turn over the entire kingdom to Solomon. Turn with me to 1 Kings chapter 2, just one page over in that pew Bible. 1 Kings chapter 2, we're going to look at verses 1 to 4. Now it says, when the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. I am about to go the way of all the earth. I'm about to die, he said. So be strong, act like a man, What a great commissioning. And observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in obedience to Him and keep His decrees and commands, His laws and regulations as written in the law of Moses. Do this so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go, and that the Lord may keep His promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a successor on the throne. So you can see the script is being written. David essentially says to Solomon, be a man, obey God, and all will go well with you. Be a man, obey God, and all will go well with you. It seems like an easy commissioning. And so Solomon embraces it. He embraces it with all that he is. And yet in chapter 3, we begin to see a slightly different story unfold. So flip over to chapter 3 of 1 Kings. We'll start again with the very first verse. 1 Kings 3, verse 1. Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace in the temple of the Lord in the wall around Jerusalem. We're going to read two more verses, but before we get there, anybody who's Jewish and knew the Old Testament would immediately know, Solomon, you have done something wrong. You see, the entire nation of Israel has been one that paints this amazing picture of a nation, really a bunch of different tribes that were brought together and unified under King David, not because they were an incredible, powerful nation, but because God had led them there. Not because they had made alliances with other kings, but because God had done absolutely miraculous things to demonstrate the power of the nation of Israel. So again, any Jew would be saying, Solomon, you made an alliance with a king from another nation? That means you don't have to rely on God. You see, what happened in ancient Near East is anybody who had a certain bit of territory, they looked to align themselves with anybody around them so that they essentially insulated themselves from attacks. And yet Israel has always been set apart. Israel had always been different. Israel was defended by God, not because of alliances. And so chapter 3, verse 1, Solomon made an alliance with the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And immediately, the alarm bells start going off. To compound that, he actually made an alliance by marrying the daughter, the princess of Egypt. Again, Jews would have said, Solomon, what in the world are you doing? Solomon, God has said that you are not to intermarry with any other countries, with no other nations. And this wasn't because of racism or xenophobia. This was because God knew that if people were to intermarry, if Israel were to bring other nations into their country, that they would soon begin worshiping other gods. And so Solomon knew exactly what he was doing when he married the Egyptian princess. And all of the Jews would have been watching and wondering, Solomon, what are you doing? Now, it's ironic because if we continue on with the rest of chapter 3 and even the next 4 or 5 chapters, we begin to see this amazing story unfold of Solomon's greatness. And yet the irony is we begin to see the seeds of disobedience. We begin to see the seeds of compromise. We begin to see the seeds of idolatry laid here. And even though Solomon's reign and his kingdom continues to grow, the seeds of compromise have been planted, and eventually they'll yield a toxic fruit. In fact, years ago, a good buddy taught me kind of a little anecdote to evaluate life. He called it a life map, and I'll give you a kind of a picture of what my life map looks like, and then we'll take a look at Solomon's life map as well to try and analyze it. But a life map is basically an opportunity to see where the highs and lows in life have been, and then see if you can identify why life seemed to be good, your kind of happiness quotient was high or your happiness quotient was low, and then hopefully identify why that's the case. And if it's high, you attempt to repeat those highs, and if it's low, you try to avoid or maybe even eliminate the lows. So here's what my life map looks like. Jason's life map. So I divide my life up into basically decades. I've got childhood, my teen years, my college years, post-college, early marriage, grad school, and no early marriage down is not because of my wife and getting married and all that. I'll explain that in just a second. Early marriage, grad school, and early adulthood and children. So I was raised with three brothers and two incredible parents, intact parents. They raised us, I think, really, really well. We had a great education. We had tremendous opportunity. They gave us a lot of affirmation and self-esteem. So my childhood and my teenage years were excellent. So you can see that I'm above average. My happiness quotient was really, really high. In college, my happiness quotient was also very high. But in late college, I started to wonder, what am I going to do with myself? What am I going to do with my time? And I really didn't know the answer to that question. And so you can see my happiness kind of start to dip in late college. Starts to dip all the way through post-college because, again, I meandered through a couple of different jobs, public relations, advertising, did a little bit of computer software training. And so as I kind of meandered through life, I had a lot of questions. Why in the world am I doing what I'm doing, and what in the world am I supposed to do in the long term? Then I essentially found what I was called to do, which I believe is what we're doing right now. My wife and I were married. We went to grad school in Boston, and life kind of took an uphill swing, and the happiness quotient went way, way up. And you may have heard my story, but in graduate school, I went through kind of a really bad spiritual crisis. And by that, I mean I graduated from a seminary really wondering if I believed in God at all. And as you can imagine, that was a really, really difficult time. So the happiness quotient takes a nosedive. Post-grad school and in early adulthood and kids. With kids, obviously the quotient goes up, and then there's a dot, dot, dot to the right. Now, if you haven't done anything like that, it's a really, really cool and fun exercise and helps you to identify what are the highs and lows in life, and more importantly, maybe why are the highs and lows in life? Where is God's fingerprints on those highs and lows? Well, let's apply this same grid and template to Solomon's life, because this is interesting. In Solomon's life, you kind of divide it in childhood and teen years, maybe young adulthood, early kingship, late kingship, and finally death. So childhood and teenage years, Solomon, son of King David, maybe the greatest king of Israel that's ever lived. The privilege, the power, the opportunity that Solomon had was literally limitless. In his young adulthood, he receives kind of the tapping from God that he is going to be the next king of Israel. Again, opportunity beyond our imaginations. In his early kingship, Solomon is given wisdom and wealth and privilege beyond our imaginations. So again, his star continues to rise. And then if we were to read further, which we'll talk about next week, we see that in Solomon's late kingship, his boat, his star, sinks beyond imagination and never resurfaces. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, we see Solomon saying things like he can't imagine what the meaning or purpose of life is, that there is none. It's meaningless. It's nothing but a chasing after the wind. And he dies a lonely, isolated, sad man. And so we wonder, Solomon, what in the world went wrong? Solomon, with so much privilege, with so much opportunity, you let it go. What went wrong? And I think through the story of Solomon, we get to see the power and the insidiousness of sin. The power and the insidiousness of evil. You see, even though Solomon was just making small compromises, a little bit here, a little bit there, the reality is those small compromises had a tremendous impact in his life. And through Solomon's life, we learn that if we give sin just an inch, it'll take a mile. That if we allow the door to crack and compromise just a little bit in our lives, even though it may just be a little bit, and we may feel like we're in control, because Solomon definitely felt like he was in control, eventually it begins to take over our lives. You see, I think if we had confronted Solomon and said, Solomon, dude, you are not to intermarry with other nations. You are not to take on other wives. I guarantee you, Solomon would have said something like this. Come on. It's just once. And by the way, you don't have any political background at all. You don't know what it's like to be king. I'm making an alliance, and this is the shrewd, this is the wise thing to do. Come on. Really, you're being a little bit of a prude. It's not that big a deal. It's just one. And if you know the history of Solomon's life, you know that it wasn't just one. One led to two. Two led to three. And eventually, Solomon had 700 wives. 700 wives. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems like a crazy number. 700 wives and 300 concubines. It's astounding to think about. And all of these, allegedly, were to build up his kingdom, to fortify his kingdom. And so looking at the outside, we may say common sense would say, gosh, Solomon, you've got to be the strongest king out there. And yet one compromise led to two. And a small bit of disobedience got bigger. And eventually, it brought about his downfall. Now, we may have said to Solomon, Solomon, you cannot allow people to worship on high places. In fact, let's finish that passage in chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 2, the writer of 1 Kings says this. Chapter 3, verse 2, the people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the instructions given him by his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on high places. Now again, any Jew would say, Solomon, those high places needed to be eliminated. And if we were to go to him and say, what are you doing? I think Solomon would have said, look, come on. It's really not that big a deal. I mean, they're just gods up there, right? We can go and worship there. And yet any Jew knew that if those high places were allowed to stick around, that they would be tempted. And temptation leads to desire. And desire leads to sin. And the scriptures say sin leads to death. And yet Solomon allowed these small compromises, this little piece of idolatry, a little bit of disobedience in the door. And when it grabbed a foothold, it took over his entire life. See, the power of evil is superhuman. You give it an inch, and it'll take a mile. You crack the door open to it, and eventually, it could and most likely will lead to death. Sin's victory doesn't occur overnight. It actually occurs through small little steps. A little compromise here, a little compromise there. And that was Solomon's problem. You see, over time, he began to loosen his grip on God. And even though early on in his kingship, Solomon worshipped God, he was faithful. Over time, he allowed these little compromises to get inside. And eventually, his entire kingdom was ripped out of his hands. Well, are you and I that different than Solomon? I mean, we may not be kings. We may not have the power or the privilege or the wealth or the authority that he had. And yet in many ways, I very often feel like I've got control over my life. That even though I may just compromise a little here and maybe just a little bit there, I feel like I've got control over it. When in fact, the exact opposite is true. That if we allow the door to crack in our lives, in our relationships, in our thoughts, in our desires, in our jobs, in our dating relationships, in our marriages, in our parenting, if we allow the door to crack to it, eventually it can, and the scriptures say it will, take over. Are we that different than Solomon? There are a couple of things that I think we can do to avoid this compromise, or maybe even call the compromise what it is, to identify what this disobedience or these little cracks look like. And the couple of things are, one, to identify it, to say it like it is, to call it like it is, to identify where in the world are those little areas in our lives where maybe we're compromising a little bit. And they may not be exactly what Solomon did, building high places, having idols, intermarrying with other nations. And yet all of us have little elements of disobedience, of idolatry, of compromise. And so the first step is to call it like it is, to identify it. The second step is to confess it. And I think we got to confess both to God and maybe even to another person. So we identify where those small compromises are. We then confess them both to God and to somebody else. And thirdly, we seek to eliminate it. So the question for you and for me is, where in the world are you, or where in the world am I compromising? Like Solomon, where are we allowing small little things to get in the way of what we know is good and right and true? Where are our thoughts being compromised? Where are our actions? Where are our desires being compromised? We need to identify it. We need to confess it. And lastly, we need to eliminate it. You see, had Solomon taken these steps, I think he may have gone down as the greatest king in Israel's history, maybe the greatest king of all time. And yet instead, we kind of look at Solomon and say, this is a king that could have been. This is a king maybe that should have been. And I think in our lives, it may be the same way. Because again, this is not just a history lesson. This is a lesson for you. And it's a lesson for me. Because Solomon's life could have taken a very, very different tack. But we can't rewrite Solomon's history. And yet your story and my story is still being written. And so where in the world are you and I compromising? And how can we identify it? How can we confess it? And ultimately, eliminate it. Next week, we're going to talk about what happened to Solomon once he got in so deep, he didn't know what to do. How he could have avoided it, and then what he could have done as a result. So come join us for part two of What Went Wrong. I'm going to close in prayer as the guys come up to lead us in worship. God, thank you for the story of Solomon. Thank you that despite his disobedience, his compromise, that we get to learn from that. Thank you that you've placed around us wise people, wise counsel, who can help us, God. We recognize that you love us. You desire great, great things for us. And so we pray that each of us can take this to heart, God, to identify where are the ways that we are compromising in our lives, in our thoughts, in our actions. I pray, God, that you would help to reveal to us what those are. Help us to have the courage to confess them and ultimately to eliminate them by the power of your Spirit. I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.